19 Uniform, thank you, descend flight level 110.
0, Shuttle 19 Uniform, join 28 Romeo Yankee, we're climbing flight level 70 on the Otago departure.
Emirates 6 after Bay, continue right to unknown navigation now to Dulles.
Blue Messenger for Victor Hotel, turn right heading 325.
Hello and welcome to For Flying Out Loud, a podcast that aims to inspire, empower and help all of our listeners to dream bigger. Who hasn't once dreamt of flying free, without the need for wings, soaring through the air just like Iron Man, made famous by the fictional character Tony Stark in the Hollywood film series? Well, if this sounds too much like science fiction, then you'd be forgiven for thinking that it would never be possible in reality. How many of us out there have had a dream to create something unique? An idea, gadget, or ultra cool concept, but never tried to turn it into reality, or have given up at the first signs of difficulty. My guest in this episode started an epic journey to turn his dream into reality several years ago, augmenting the human body with high-tech technology that has truly turned science fiction into real-life fact. And trust me, it's super cool. I can't wait to talk to them about this journey and the super exciting developments that are sure to come. The For Flying Out Loud podcast is brought to you by Flight Deck Wingman, helping all pilots achieve their aviation aspirations.
As you go, you stand, you're ready to take off, you instigate start, you can hear six little solenoids tick over as the fuel valves open. The engines then build as more fuel goes in. You get to about 30,000 RPM and that's a lot of noise. At that moment, you know there's no going back. You hold your arms out, you squeeze that trigger. So you lower your arms down, you feel the weight come off your feet gradually until the ground disappears. And suddenly, despite being at the core of all of that fury, it goes peaceful. You simply just think about where you want to go and you just go there. It is unlike anything else I've ever experienced.
He is a former oil trader and Royal Marines reservist who, over the period of several years, created a concept that would enable us to break the bonds of gravity without the need for wings and take us into the realm usually reserved only for birds and aircraft. It's certainly been a journey of ups and downs, but as far as an inspirational journey to turn dream into reality goes, it doesn't get much cooler than this. Today, it is a huge pleasure and extremely exciting to welcome this real-life Iron Man to the podcast. He has gained global notoriety and the interest of some of the world's leading industries, marketeers, and even the military with his awesome concept. Richard Browning, founder of Gravity Industries, chief test pilot and designer of the totally awesome jet seat, a very warm welcome to For Flying Out Loud.
Thanks, Andrew. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to see you, Richard. Thanks so much for giving your time today. I know how busy you are. Richard, you actually brought up not too far away from me, actually, down the road in Camberley. I'm over in Farnham. And I got really stuck into your book, which is amazing, by the way. Everyone needs to go out there and buy it or listen to the audiobook. But one of the things that stood out to me right at the beginning was the challenge that you faced at school with dyslexia. And it was something that I recently spoke to another fast jet pilot about, who also had dyslexia. And I was really interested to hear about how you sort of coped with that challenge at school and the sort of things you did. And could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I mean, I it's a sort of spectrum, isn't it? I don't think I'm particularly afflicted, if you like. I think I was fairly mild, but certainly it was... it's good to blame that for my terrible handwriting, my awful spelling, and general not great English skills, I would say, from a written point of view anyway. I think I benefited from the fact that the science around this has sort of grown up around the same time, you know, as I did. I mean, I'm, 42? And at school, I remember that there was, you know, quite decent recognition of dyslexia. And it's annoying. I mean, it fits nicely with my general challenge around conventional education. You know, I never fitted particularly well. I was never particularly good at just following what everybody else was doing. And that included all the sort of reading and writing kind of things. But I think as is quite well understood now, that the flip side of that is it seems to let you... you compensate in other ways. I think thinking creatively in three-dimensional space, you mentioned, you know, a pilot having that as well. I think there are things that outweigh the negatives with a forgiving schooling environment, reasonably forgiving schooling environment, then yeah, you can get by, I think.
It's one of the things that actually sort of stands out to me is that we have this sort of mechanism in schools where we judge people by exam grades, you know, and passing these sort of pretty old school sort of processes, really, when you think about it. And we've got so many young people out there that actually possibly never realise their true potential because they're just sort of marked down by exam results. And I personally wish, although we've got to have some sort of yardstick somewhere, that perhaps there were different yardsticks that we could measure people's capability by so that you could realise their potential.
Yeah, I mean, the education system is a whole nother podcast, isn't it, really? I mean, I think it's undeniable. It was a structure built up around the kind of workhouses, white-collar, blue-collar workers, and you needed people to be numerate and literate so they could follow instructions and work for your overlords, as it were. It's not a bad general yardstick and structure to get people sort of spat out into the world with a decent basic set of skills. But the big bugbear is that in a modern world full of machines that are better at those kind of tasks than us, the remaining skills where we really excel are the creative, imaginative, piecing together disparate bits of information and thinking up things that never existed before. Clearly a passion of mine, but the school system struggles in most cases to cater for that kind of thing. You know, it's more about everybody shut up and listen to the textbook and regurgitate. That's an increasingly not very useful skill. It's a tough one. I do sympathise with teachers and it's hard to come up with a miraculous immediate fix for this. I think just a tolerance for the creative thought or creative thinkers and the annoying kids that put their hands up in the back of the class and want to keep asking why, as much tolerance for them as possible, I think is the most you can ask for at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things actually, though, during your school life was that your dad would let you pretty much figure out the inner workings of pretty much anything. And there was one story in the book. All I'm going to say is that I'm glad we have LED televisions these days.
Yes.
Didn't you? You investigated an old school cathode ray tube TV, didn't you, Richard? What
happened? Yeah, no, I still remember that. Yeah, I, it was great. I mean, I still do this with my kids now, carefully taking apart sort of old broken things. Not usually with much hope of ever fixing them, but it's always interesting to delight in all the bits inside. And yeah, one notable point, yes, I remember recalling this in the book, cathode ray TV, you know, where you've got the great big glass tube. But it quite interestingly peters out into a very fragile, small, I think it's the ray emitter right at the back of the structure, which is then obviously firing electrons out towards the fluorescent screen. That bit was just too tantalizing to not leave alone. And I knocked it very gently with a hammer a few times. Nothing really happened until I obviously knocked it hard enough. And it's a vacuum in there. So the whole thing sort of negatively exploded. And it felt like my eyeballs came out because obviously there's a momentary little vacuum in the vicinity of where I was bashing it. And that scared the hell out of me. I mean, since I've discovered that there's potentially, even if you've had the TV turned off for a long time, the amount of charge that can be kept in the capacitors in the back of one of those TVs can be quite lethal. Neither my father nor myself obviously knew this at the time. But anyway, I managed to survive that escapade. But
obviously, you take things much more easy these days, Richard.
Our whole innovation ethos is all about, you know, taking risk, but making sure it's recoverable and survivable risk. And yes, that one was an unknowing risk, which we hadn't actually covered properly, I guess, in hindsight.
You mentioned the blue collar sort of network, but you actually sort of entered this sort of network when you went off to work for BP, and you got there actually through an interview because you'd actually created this bit of clothing called the Head Over, which was, I think, it's keep your head warm but your neck warm at the same time. I seem to remember those. You know, I'm sure I remember those back in the day. Why didn't that make it into mass production?
Yeah, I suppose even from a young age, I was quite taken with the idea of running my own business and, you know, earning my own money. And at university, yeah, I was in the officer training corps, and you know, back then, and I guess soldiers always complain about their equipment, but back then The equipment was pretty poor, you know, sort of cotton trousers, cotton shirt, you know, cotton t-shirt and a woolen jumper, I seem to remember. And this was in Sennybridge in South Wales. You know, when it's cold and wet, all of those items are pretty miserable. Useless. Yeah. So I was kind of hunting around for what piece of small clothing that you could add that would have a disproportionate effect to your sort of body temperature. And this sort of fleecy neck gaiter idea was knocking around. And I can't remember where the idea came from. I didn't invent it. But I was quite taken with the concept because you can draw the top together into a beanie hat as well. And the idea was you're, you know, marching along, tapping along in the middle of the night and you're getting cold. or if you're getting hot, let's say, you can take it off by just taking your helmet off quickly. And if you're getting cold, you can slide it back on again. And it did have a big sort of scarf-like effect on your body temperature. So, yeah, accidentally, that turned into quite a decent little business where a whole network of people in the wider area used to sew these things for me, and I'd get them all distributed around the country. It was really, its main value was creating a really quite nice example of, I suppose, entrepreneurial thinking, which probably helped me get my eventual undergraduate job initially with the oil company. But yeah, it was good. It was good. It was a great example of just getting out there and learning from getting your hands dirty, because it had all the elements of a typical business, you know, supply and demand and manufacturing and marketing and all the rest of it.
Yeah, it must have served you super well. And as you said, it helped you get this this job as an oil trader. But you didn't really, it seems to me anyway, sort of really enjoy this oil trading aspect of it. You got stuck in some other things called blockchain and GEM, and that all sounded really, really quite techy. And if I'm right, it was to do with sort of helping ships not hit each other. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, I spent 16 years with BP in the end, most of it actually running a trading book. And I mean, I love the challenge. It was like running your own business, because you're constantly making lots of decisions, many of which fail, but you have to survive those failures, make sure you recover from them, and have your often smaller number of successes outweigh the failures from a financial perspective. So those are all the ingredients that have latterly turned out to be the very helpful behaviors when it comes to running a, you know, innovative company. You're constantly making small bets and trying to get more of them to pay off, you know, to a greater scale than your failures. So that was good. And going around, running around the world, doing all sorts of interesting business development, I ended up going to places like Libya and Mozambique and Turkmenistan and all sorts of. Yeah, it was a pretty interesting existence, but still didn't really do everything I wanted it to do. But yes, towards the last years, I built on a very early stage career success I had on the technology front. Same behaviors here, it's kind of consistent, I think, with a lot of your questions. I kind of spotted something that looked interesting, and it later turned into this ship tracking system, which it's now used as a mainstay of many of the world's commodity traders, where you can see the location of all the world's ships, and you can kind of use that to help build your supply-demand balance for any particular given commodity. And I turned a $30,000 kind of punt, if you like, in this technology into, to be honest, it was around $500 million for this trading organization about 9 months later. It was a contributing factor towards delivering that money, but undeniably created an enormous kind of storm and gave us about a 12-month head start on the rest of the competition. So that very much weaned me onto, if I needed any weaning, onto the quite addictive journey of seeing an interesting idea, realizing that most people think it's not going to work, realizing that most of the time those people are right, unfortunately, but one time in 20, when they're not, it outweighs all the 19 failures when you realize you've just done something no one's ever done before. And set me on a pathway to wanting to do many more of those kind of things.
And it wasn't like totally sort of welcomed by some of the sort of senior people. I think one of the phrases in the book said, there's people with big boots around here, they're not afraid to use them. And do you know, that sort of experience, I think many people in life, when you're setting out to do these really cool things, you do something a bit different, or you stand out for doing something cool or something different, often met, isn't it, with that sort of response, which I think is a bit of a shame.
I've latterly got involved in various of the quite senior military circles and military technology arena, obviously because what we do and the progress we're having in that, so, you know, in that kind of community.
Yeah.
But we're being used, and it's quite, you know, I'm delighted this is happening. We're being used as a little bit of an example, a quite prickly example of how technology can and should accelerate quicker, because we rub right up against the sort of inertia, if you like, in the system when it comes to embracing new technology. I could speak for several hours on this, and I often get paid to go around the world and do this, but in summary that you know, I am absolutely passionate that this awful word innovation, and I say awful because it gets beaten around all over the place by many people who've never done anything innovative, but know it's a good thing to talk about. It is absolutely critical that we get as good as we can get around doing this. Innovation is about doing more things better. You know, it's absolutely critical that you are constantly evolving and adapting to keep more competitive, to keep, you know, ahead of or alongside your competitors, and in the military circles, to minimize the casualties you have when you have your next conflict, and maximize your effectiveness. And yet, we live in a society that has focused obsessively on risk, No one likes risk. No one likes hurting themselves. No one likes, you know, incurring reputational or financial damage. And therefore, there is a community that has rightly gone after zero risk. However, ironically, the pursuit of that zero risk kills any chance of innovation. Innovation is all about, everything you see behind me in my lab here, is all about doing stuff that's never been done before, but analyzing immediately what is the worst that can happen. Is it survivable and recoverable from a financial safety and reputation perspective? If it is, we do it the same day. And then we learn those lessons and move on in advance. If you don't have an ethos of doing that, you don't innovate, you don't progress, and actually you store up a catastrophic existential failure, the biggest of all risks, you know, a decade or a year or a week later, depending on whether it's a trading book, a company or a military. You just can't get this wrong. And we do get this wrong too often. So I'm on a sort of messianic mission to try and, you know, collaboratively bring people forward out of their shells and realize this risk thing has to be managed, not eliminated.
Well, you can never eliminate all risk, can you? And I think that's the thing. I mean, if we'd have taken that approach from being Neanderthal people, then we would have never got to where we're at, because we had to take risks in order to survive. It seems a bit of a shame that...
So every success that human beings have ever you know, delivered has come about from people venturing out into the unknown and doing things they didn't know whether they were going to work out well or not. That's risk. And it is a shame when we box ourselves into a corner. And I'm thinking, you know, nearly all big organizations suffer from this. They incentivize too many people to hunt down and eliminate and extinguish every possible risk. But those are the unbeknown to them. They are the harbingers of the ultimate failure of that organization, because you don't adapt and keep up with the competition.
You're absolutely spot on. Absolutely spot on. If there are any big organizations out there listening, you need to speak more to Richard. He's spot on. Richard, though, I want to move, while you were doing all this oil trading, I want to now move into this sort of initial idea and the sort of concept behind the jet suit. So what was it that set you out on this initial path to where you are now?
Yeah, so there's a number of contributing factors which I've only come to be able to list in the last 4 years since, you know, setting up the company and being interviewed and asked this question countless times and listened to my answers and gradually refined them into why I think this happened.
Something a bit more original, I promise.
No, not at all. No, because every time I answer it, I sort of gradually chip away at this stone block underneath is the sculpture of the true answer of where this came from. Because, you know, most sort of innovative journeys aren't light bulb moments. You just wake up or bang your head and suddenly think, I know, I'll build a jet suit. This is, I think, a culmination of a number of things. So my whole family background was from the world of aviation and engineering. You know, my late father was an engineer and a maverick creator and designer and builder. His father was a wartime aviator and civil pilot after that. My other grandfather, Sir Basil Blackwell, used to run Westland Helicopters, now Leonardo's, or at least Leonardo's in the UK. So I was sort of immersed in aviation and engineering as a kid. I think my time in the Royal Marines Reserve alongside my day job gave me a real passion for human capability. This idea that when you set your mind and body to a task, whether it's an ultramarathon or calisthenics or all the other triathlon-y type things I used to do, it is amazing in hindsight. I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about the human machine. It's amazing how you can adapt this machine to be an airline pilot or a nurse or a doctor or it's mad really when you think about it.
I always
delight in an amateur kind of way of trying to apply that machine to different challenges. And then finally, I think I've always been quite, you know, inspired by that innovative journey, that idea of turning an idea into something that does something that's never been done before. And flight, you know, I used to grow up with my father building little balsa wood gliders and throwing them off hills and progressed to the heady heights of two-channel slope soaring gliders.
I remember those days, yeah.
They sound pathetic compared to
modern
drones.
The best days.
Yeah, they sound pathetic nowadays. But anyway, so I think you blend all that together, and I just hatched this idea. You know, the raw concept was, could you add the minimalist technology to the human mind and body and fly? And I don't mean like a big hang glider wing. I mean standing on the ground, standing here, you know, as I'm sitting here now talking to you. What are the minimalist things you could add to the human being to fly, using your brain as the balance machine and your body as the flight structure? No commercial reason, no logical reason whatsoever. I just thought it'd be a really interesting challenge. And I did it alongside my day job and sort of fumbled my way, failed my way safely towards this idea that if you attach these micro gas turbines, little turbojets, to the right parts of your body, then there was a chance you could make it as intuitive as, you know, surfing, skiing, riding a bike, you know, snowboarding, that kind of thing. That was the vision. still sounds mad. And that's what, you know, you can see, I mean, on our YouTube channel at Gravity Industries, you can see all over the internet, there's a TED talk, several TED talks on it, or in the Taking on Gravity book as well. You can see the quite ludicrously amateur steps in a farmyard in Wiltshire that it took to iteratively prove out all the steps that eventually got that first flight in November 2016 done.
And I've watched so many of the UT videos, probably all of them actually, prior to getting here and seeing those initial steps. But I sort of love the journey you went on, which was you didn't just say, well, I'm going to do this. You did obviously go and look for those connections between the sort of human world and the animal world. I know you went and visited animal dynamics and you were looking at how a bird's wing works. You looked at every sort of area it seemed before you sort of came upon this idea of the jets. And of course, you are sort of a real life Tony Stark from Iron Man, and he'd probably have a multi-billion-pound venue that he would have where he'd create all of his stuff if he could. And I'm looking in the background there, and what I love about it is that you've got everything. You've developed this amazing jet seat now to where it is, and looking in your laboratory, that of course the listeners can't see, it just looks exactly as I'd imagine it. It's full of amazing stuff.
It is a bit of a grown-up play area, but and we didn't have this when I was first developing this. So in fact, it was done in a mixture of a garage, a back bedroom, and this farmyard. But yeah, since launching the company, we've obviously got a really quite nice development lab now. But it's still quite small. I mean, we still, because we 3D print nearly everything we do, there's a couple of our machines running in the background now, but we also send off to get a lot of the components we use 3D printed on sort of multi-million dollar massive machines. We don't need that traditional kind of lathe and milling machine workshop. It's more of a testing and kind of research lab than anything else. But yeah, it's not the billion-dollar Tony Stark setup. I haven't got any Audi R8s and AC Cobras hanging around. I've got an old TVR in my garage, but no, I did it on a slightly reduced budget from the how the film shows it. And I should cover the Iron Man thing. I mean, it's, you know, I didn't build this. That Iron Man thing was not in my mind whatsoever when I was developing this. Obviously, as it started to come together and actually work, it did dawn on us that, oh, it does start to look a little bit like a certain Marvel superhero. Yeah. But as a traditionally miserable Brit, that whole superhero comic book thing was not anywhere near the forefront of my mind. However, having done 140 events in 35 countries with the team in the last 4 years, you know, we've travelled around quite a bit, including a lot in the US and including a lot in California and around Comic-Con and things like that. I've got a newfound respect for that whole kind of superhero comic book genre, if you like, because when you stop and pause for a minute and just, you know, dismiss the immediate British assumption, it's all very childish. Actually, apart from being a multi-billion dollar entertainment franchise, that whole DC Marvel type thing, actually, when you distill pure human creativity and don't worry about physics or making money and just think, wouldn't it be cool if I could fly or be invisible or be super strong? Then the superhero world cracks on with it. And it's funny how technology limps along several decades behind, trying its best to try and replicate that. You know, the mobile phone is the most insane concept that would sound like witchcraft 30, 40 years ago, and fulfills a whole bunch of almost fantasy-like human desires. And we've all now got them. So in a weird way, I've sort of reflected that the whole, you know, dream of flying as raw and intimately as you could possibly get, well, we've sort of delivered a bit on that. I mean, it's not quite as compact and instant as Mr. Stark's system, but it sort of sets a cool target in some ways. You know, our system now starts up in 15 seconds from cold. You know, we've done ridiculous tests with the latest system where you can be standing next to this gear sitting on a table and within less than 60 seconds, you're in the air. You know, wow. I mean, you know, it's not quite you press your button and get wrapped in all this special titanium stuff, but it's, it's quite fun to not be quite so instantly dismissive of that in hindsight.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I really like was you talk about embracing failure and enjoying failure as well, and all of those early attempts flying.
The whole enjoying failure. No, I think I caveat that. No, it's all very luxurious to sit back and go, well, yes, you know, you have to endure the failures. Whilst you're failing, it's as miserable as hell. You question everything. You're wondering whether you're going down the wrong route. But there is no real, you know, for anybody trying to run their own business or set up an idea or whatever, you know, who's listening to this, there is no magic bullet solution to this. You have to 1 minute be absolutely dead set and never give up, never say die, you know, like some sort of special forces ninja, you know, never giving up. And then literally in a heartbeat go, oh, actually, the evidence has changed. I've now got to drop everything like I never cared in the slightest and pivot and move a different direction. That is an impossibly different balance to strike. And no one's going to tell you when to make one decision versus the other. It's very hard, you know, to build anything new, whether it's a business or a product or whatever. It's very hard.
That's so true. On that second point, I find that as a small business owner, trying to drop, so you've worked so hard every hour, not enough hours in a day, you could work 24 hours a day, something isn't working, and having that acceptance, yeah, you know what, this isn't working, I've got to move on. That's a really, really difficult thing to do.
And the trading world, you know, there's lots of really helpful parallels when you're running a trading book, or if you're, you know, even just investing your own stocks and shares. You know, one minute you're absolutely committed and you put a painfully chunky amount of money on a particular position. And then, you know, yeah. What? If the conditions change, you know, Bank of England makes a decision about interest rates or something, and the market moves, you've suddenly got to drop all of that, because all the evidence coldly, this is why computers are good traders, all the evidence has changed, so you unemotionally swing from being long to being short. You're not just going to sell a bit of your length, you know, a bit of your positive position, to be clear. You know, that you're still long, you know, you've got to change because the conditions have changed. So there's lots of painful lessons when it comes to financial trading that actually could be applied to running a small business.
Absolutely. I want to get stuck into some of the sort of techie stuff around this. And I was sticking with most of it until he started talking about pulse width modulation and various other things. But some of the sort of things that he did to design and overcome. So a few industries he reached out to. One was the medical industry. I think that was to do with looking at fuel lines and having bubbles in the fuel lines, something like that.
Yeah, so a problem we had in the early days with the old fuel system we used to use was that, you know, you jump around trying to get a system to work and start to feel the balance, because I was having to sort of teach myself to fly this, assuming it was even possible, at the same time. And one stupid problem was, you know, you jump around a lot and you end up getting air bubbles down the fuel lines, which means the engines at best cough and at worst shut down. So one of the ideas that suddenly, you know, the sort of nice, elegant adaptation of technology from another industry was that, you know, no one wants bubbles in an intravenous line, because that, I think, that really messes you up. If you pump a bubble into your veins, it's not a good day out.
Yeah.
So they have actual optical sensors that look for bubbles. So I spoke to a company that made them and they sent them over. We got a little bit of code written, and it would be a sensor that was upstream of the engine by quite a long way. And it would turn on a big red light in my line of sight if it saw a bubble, which was enough time to land. We've since solved that with lots of different alternative ways of doing it. But it was a really lovely repurposing of existing available technology, which is a key part of how we innovate. If you can get 80% of the learnings of a particular experiment from repurposing something that you can buy on Amazon or eBay, then just knock yourself out. I mean, we used to do that all the time. Still do, whenever we can.
It's getting harder and harder to find things online now. I mean, you know, that idea to look to the medical industry, you probably had an idea, I'm imagining now talking to you, but I imagine just getting to that bit of research and going, yeah, that's the thing I need. That probably didn't happen overnight. That was probably weeks of research.
Well, it can do. So the process goes something along the lines of, you know, I've got a bubble. How do I stop it going into the engine? Or how do I catch it? Or how do I see it? So often the process is as simple as this. You Google image search. You do this from your couch. You Google image search some keywords like bubble sensor, bubble trap, whatever, and see what images come up. And honestly,
things, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, sometimes some unexpected things can pop up when you follow this approach. Yes, I will admit. My profile on Google must be a bit weird, I imagine. And then you end up seeing, you know, a whole bunch of things, many of which you're expecting. And every now and then a little image will pop up of something you didn't even know existed. So you click on it, you find it's got a name. You then research for the name of the thing and suddenly find a whole load more images of that thing. And then start looking on Amazon or eBay, usually, because it's just nice and quick and easy, whether you can get one of these things. And literally within the space of 20 minutes, that thing's then arriving the next day. And it does. I mean, here's a silly example. The backpack structure of our jet suits in the early days used to be child carriers. You know, the kind of thing you take a toddler for a hike in. Now, to be clear, you're not hanging off that. The climbing harness structure would be where we woven through that and the engine clamps. So that would be then taking the load. But the static load of walking around with the fuel tanks and the engine on your back, or engines in those days, would be similar to a heavy kid. And guess what? Somebody had already done all the hard work on making a very light, very strong, very comfortable backpack structure. So why not go and use that? You know, just disguise it a little bit. And hey, presto, I did all of the early day flights for a few months with those systems and no one ever noticed.
Amazing. And now looking at how it's developed now, it's just incredible. I mean, it's like night and day, but it's great to see that evolution. Mm. I'm imagining those sort of the monkey turning into a man type analogy here with backpacks turning into what it is today. It's incredible, really. And you obviously don't like to throw anything away, which would be music to my dad's ears, because he keeps everything for years, just in case, just for that one day you can
we have to be
coming useful.
That is annoying. I am naturally like that. I've had to teach myself to be quite brutal on throwing things away. Otherwise, we do repurpose a lot, but yes, at the same time, we can't possibly keep hold of everything here. In fact, having a relatively limited space here, there's about six of us usually working here, we're always short of space, so we tend to cannibalize the oldest prototype, and that goes and supports the latest system. So that keeps us quite tidy to a degree.
And you got all sort of low tech stuff like the backpack. I think you had your wife's pink iPhone, which would vibrate if you're about to run out of fuel.
So we used to fly by time quite a bit. So you knew you had 2 minutes of fuel. So you have an iPhone stuffed in your sock for an event and it vibrate like crazy after 60 seconds, which gave you a pretty good warning that you've got a few, you should be landing in the next 10, 15 seconds. Again, just a really simple, basic, fairly foolproof solution. You used to have somebody in the audience, if it was a complicated event, that would wave after a minute as well. So if the iPhone, fallen out or something, then, you just solve the problem. You just work out what's the worst that can happen, and get on with it.
Yeah, amazing. And some pretty high-tech stuff as well, though, which sort of I like, from FastJet World now into even the 787 that I fly. I've got this head-up display, and you've even got a head-up display inside the visor now, which is really cool. What sort of info does that give you?
Yeah, I mean, the whole heads-up display thing, we've played with lots of different versions over the years. Many years ago, we used to have a very sophisticated helmet system that would, it could even very unhelpfully paint the heads-up display data onto the surface of an external structure. So you could see your fuel data rendered onto the side of a building as you flew past. Very fancy, completely useless. But anyway, that's how fancy some of the stuff was. If I'm really honest, because literally 140 events in 35 separate countries is what we've done now, whether they're military or search and rescue or commercial events, often under a lot of pressure with no real reconnaissance of the location, whether it's deserts, mountains, snow, wherever. I mean, it's been like a mad journey all over the world, but earned us a lot of money as well, which has been great. But that has taught us to build almost a military level of robustness and capability in what we do, not for the military, although that has now come to pass, but originally just to be reliable and consistent of cracking open some gear in Saudi Arabia in the middle of the night, ready for an event the next day, having it been beaten around an airline, and only traveled in check-in suitcases. You needed to perform, right? And maybe the event organizers weren't particularly sympathetic to the idea that you had a problem. You just had to deal with it. So it's built a very great culture in our organization just to get on and make stuff super robust. So the challenge with the heads-up display system is we did a few events where the most painful part of it was getting the heads up wirelessly to talk to the control system, and woe betide you to be dependent on that. So there's many events where you'd fly with a heads-up display system. It looked like it was on, but it wasn't, because it just hadn't synced properly or something really lame. So we've got very good at not relying on anything too fancy. I'm sure you're the same, that, you've got a heads-up display system. I'm sure you have all the backup instrumentation anyway, because if that drops out or battery problems or whatever. 100%. Right, so yes, we fly with them sometimes. It's mostly fuel and engine data. So during startup, you can see all the engines coming up to temperature and RPMs and EGTs and things, exhaust gas temperatures and stuff all look right. Once you're in the air, you don't want to be bombarded with too much, a bit like a kind of fighter pilot. You don't really want to be gazing into the middle distance at a load of information. Flight time is the critical thing. We still mostly fly by time. You don't go and fall into the miserable trap of trying to convert liters into into time left and all this sort of stuff. You just know you fueled for, let's say 3 or 4 minutes, and then you just make sure your flight's going to take 90 seconds. So therefore you have an alert if you've gone over 90 seconds, and you just keep it all to time. So having a big flight time indicator in your visor is quite helpful. But as I say, for the reasons I've already given, usually it's an unnecessarily faffy, complicated way of achieving a much easier solution. So I have a pendant now that you can just glance down on your chest and see the flight, which is all wired, good old wires. There's still a place for wires every now and then. So everybody that knows and loves Wi-Fi, it's quite nice when you plug a cable in sometimes.
Going old school. But you did move from, and you moved through different sort of fuels. I think are you still running on Jet A1 fuel, which you said was a bit like a flaming Sambuca, although it didn't do much damage?
No, well, so you know this. You know this about everybody. So jet fuel sounds very exciting and exotic, and like it's going to go off in a big fireball. It's the same stuff as diesel. You could run your 787 on diesel from a gas station if you were going to choose to do it. If you really wanted to, it'd just be more smoky.
Take a while to fill up, but yeah.
Yes. So you know, jet fuel, kerosene, diesel, paraffin—they're all the same family. They're all very different from gasoline, so they don't form vapor clouds very easily at all. Generally, to the mere mortals, it's very boring. Runs a tractor. You could put out cigarettes into the stuff if you were stupid enough to prove that is doesn't cause anything. You know, it really is very, very useful fuel. And this is why your industry uses it every day, because actually it's extremely high energy density and very benign in its propensity to do any nasty things. So in 4 years of using jet or diesel for events, we've never had any issue with it. It's very benign.
But if it is like a flaming Sambuca, you've obviously not been on a night out with me. I can tell you they do some damage.
I think that was some I think the flaming Sambuca thing was some artistic license from the contributor to the book. I think I'll admit that it's one of those things that people on the outside would think that it's very dangerous flying around with a load of fuel on your back. It's far more scary flying the electric version of our suit with lithium batteries on your back. That's much more scary.
Well, come to that, actually, because I've got a glider with an electric motor on the front, which I know is a bit odd. It's not really a glider, is it? It's got a motor. But it gets me out of Dodge, and that's running on two massive lithium ferrous polymer, whatever it is, batteries. You know more about that than me, Richard, but huge, great big things. And if they go up in flames, they really do go up in flames. Mm. Yeah, but they're pretty powerful.
You want an emergency, a jettison option for those. If they're right at your C of G, you want to be able to... In fact, you probably want them next to you in the cockpit. If they look dodgy, just chuck them out before they go
just
crazy.
Just chuck them out the window.
Yeah, if they're built into the flight, into the structure, you're going to have to bail out of that thing. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I've given myself... there's nothing written down other than, you know, land as soon as possible. So I've decided if I'm not high enough to jump out, I have to land really, really quickly.
Jesus, yeah, that's something to worry about. I'd say you want them jettisonable if they're in your center of gravity, but if they're not,
I'll speak to the manufacturer. I'll put you in touch. Yeah. So if you haven't got enough on your plane, no. I have actually flown a glider with a jet engine in a fuselage as well. I don't know if you knew they had those.
Yeah.
So pretty much like the ones that you have, and it was pretty cool.
It's a nice diversity between the chaos of that and the tranquility of getting back to the gliding, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. But Richard, what's it like to actually fly the jet suit? How would you describe it?
Yeah, we get asked quite a bit. Well, firstly, I can't help but say, so we run flight training and flight experiences at the Goodwood Estate. We're on the Spitfire airfield and surrounded by the old Formula One circuit. It's a wonderful location. We used to do it in LA as well. We're back out there soon. COVID's finally giving us a bit of a break. And everybody from my 14-year-old through to 80-year-olds have done it. And it's actually extremely benign because you're sort of rigged up on a little rope where that's just there so you can't stumble as you're feeling the balance, and then we gradually ramp the power up as your balance comes in, and it's like watching kids learn to ride a bike. Some get it within minutes, other take a bit longer, but we've had a huge, I think 400 to 500 people we've had through now. Anyway, what it's like is, I'd say probably the best analogy is that dream of flying that some people have sometimes, where you're walking or running. It's all very quiet. I will admit the dream is quieter than the reality. But you're walking or running along, and that moment where you just step and your foot just lifts off the ground, and then you just go effortlessly wherever your mind takes you. It is like that. You are not consciously thinking of what you're doing with your body. You just think where you're going to go and you go. So as much as it is on a bicycle, so no one agonizes over keeping their CG over the crank of a bicycle, or, you know, micro adjustments of the handlebars. You just think, oh, I'll cycle down there. You know, you just go where you want. But imagine that in three dimensions, where you're not consciously aware of being inside or on top of or strapped to a flight machine. You are the flight machine, and you just go, you know, like a really good downhill skier just feels as free as a bird. It is like that.
I need to get down and have a go, having hovered the Harrier. I need to come down and see how it feels. I can't promise I'm going to be any good at it. I think you said the Harrier pilots are pretty good at taking to it.
So yeah, we've noticed that the best skill set to mean that you literally can learn it. We've had a couple of people only 2 weeks ago came down, and they were hovering around, flying around, still with a slack tether sitting there so they can't, you know, fall over and stumble and get it wrong. But the slack tether was still there. And their first go, they were hovering and flying around. So literally within 2 minutes, they'd got it. And it is possible to do that. We've noticed that, helicopter pilots, Harrier pilots, not that there's that many of them, but that community has a bit of an unfair advantage, because that weird three-dimensional freedom of going up, down, left, right, or rotating is quite familiar, and yet this is as intuitive as that bicycle, where now if you move to one side, what do you naturally do anyway? You put your hand out looking to catch your stumble. Yeah. Well, now there's already a surface called thrust that feels like just a surface, but it's now anywhere you want. So your brain very Amazing. Quickly goes, oh, this is like way easier than walking, because walking, I'm a wobbly, top-heavy lump that's trying to desperately not fall over. Whereas now
too
I'm
much a little time in lockdown.
Now I'm a sort of camera tripod of thrust, where there's thrust on your back and thrust on each arm, and your brain wires very quickly to realizing that you are that sort of. I suppose in your world, you know, your wingtip vectors that you had on the Harrier, you know, you've now got them in the palm of your hand. So now, rather than having to wire your brain to get used to a stick and the throttle and the nozzles levers, which is all really counterintuitive, really alien, and a helicopter pilot, it's not that much better in terms of your collective and cyclic are a bit not massively logical. You don't have to do all that. It's just you, and so you do it all in this sort of wonderfully intuitive way. So yeah, it is an amazing experience to feel that. It's very addictive.
It must be really amazing to see that idea that you had to bring the human body and mind together into a flying machine and actually feel that that's been achieved. It feels exactly as you imagined it.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of imagined the concept, but I was my own biggest critic or skeptic inside as to whether this mad idea would work. I mean, you mentioned about wings and things very early on, and I don't cover this very often, but very early on, the idea was to, could you sort of augment your arm and chest muscles with the glute and back muscles in a sort of clever cableized way to actually support wings? I mean, you're laughing. It sounds bonkers, doesn't it? I still harbor some ambition to get close to that, but quickly I realized
my glutes are not good for supporting
anything. Yeah. Well, you know, if you can box jump, you know, a couple of feet off the ground, well, you've got the muscular first wing beat of a bird, right? There you go. That's all they're doing, but they're repeating and getting momentary purchase on the airflow with their wings. That's all they're doing. I say all, but it is a hard ask because we're pretty heavy and our musculature is spread around the place, and even the bird world struggled to get anywhere near the weight of a human being off the ground. So I've sort of cheated by going and covering off the horsepower problem with these little micro gas turbines. You know, the nominal power of these things is about 1,000 horsepower if you crudely equate thrust to horsepower. So I've sort of cheated in that way. But yes, I'm using human balance and human structure. You know, a lot of people look at what we do and think, oh my God, it must rip your arms off, you know, all this sort of stuff. No, not at all. So what you can do is you stand on a bathroom scales, register your weight, lean forward on the bathroom sink without ripping it off the wall, hopefully, with roughly straight arms, like you're leaning on a sort of worktop, kitchen worktop, and keep leaning in a very relaxed way until you register only a third of your body weight left on those scales. You're now supporting two-thirds of your body weight. You'll notice it's not hard. Your arms are roughly locked out, and you could do that all evening chatting to somebody in a pub, right? That's all I'm doing. I'm just leaning. All these people that think that, you know, the thrust of those engines should be ripping my arms from their sockets. Well, no, the physics doesn't work like that. If you bolted my feet to the ground and then put loads more power on there, yes, you're going to sort of stretch my arms off. But no, I'm just going to lift off the ground, but with the massive benefit that I'm in this really elegant degree. I have this elegant degree of control of the thrust vectoring, which means, amongst other things, this system can never fail upwards. No gyro or ECU, unlike what happens to some of our filming drones sometimes, can accelerate me off into a wall or climb 100 feet and then cut out. None of that happens. So my failure modes are restricted to simply down, which I'm entirely in control of, because I can thrust vector my way to, you know, even in gusting 50 mile an hour winds, I could come and, you know, eat a chocolate bar out of your hand, which we've done this.
I saw that last week.
I know. I mean, it's kind of a stupid application of it, but it just shows how amazingly brilliant your brain is at adaptive balance. So anyway,
you've had some pretty nasty crashes, I'm guessing, in the first instances of testing out the seat, and then developed it to what it is now, where you feel so in control.
Yeah, all the early crashes were a few feet onto a concrete farmyard, you know, and I mean literally two or 3 feet, which are not fun. But I used to cycle commute across London for 10 years, and I use that as my benchmark of risk. Really, if what we're doing is going to result in an injury worse than I was. I mean, I had a couple of quite bad ones, but seem to be quite good at falling over without hurting myself too badly. But anyway, I went over a couple of cars in my time of commuting across London. And we try as far as possible to fly in a manner where failure is acceptable, right? So, We never fly very high or very fast over a surface that is pretty unforgiving. Yes, there's some instances where, like Top Gear, I was racing Freddie Flintoff up the Welsh mountainside. There are a few parts of that flight where, that would have smarted a bit, but not killed me, possibly broken a collarbone or something, again, like coming off a bike, but we're terrain hugging really low and over relatively soft surfaces as much as we can, because we do not believe we are infallible, for sure.
Yeah. But it comes back to that, not being able to eliminate all the risks, like you're talking about right at the beginning of this podcast, where you're saying, well, I'm going to take some risks. And, I guess if something happens, you think, well, I didn't think that would happen. Now I need to think of a way to stop that happening again. Or is there
it's making those failures recoverable. So it's not flying at 100 feet. We're working through some details of an event in Dubai in about 10 days time. And, there's all these ones. Can you fly and, fly up to the top of the Burj, Khalifa Tower and all this sort of rubbish. It's like, look, I say to our special forces folks, you can. There's nothing technically, it's not pushing off the ground. It's amazing how many people think that this pushes off the ground, which is a big physics black mark.
Yeah.
You could, right? And if your SWAT team is taking casualties and needs some top cover right now, go do it, right? You've got a 1 in 1,000 chance of there being an engine problem, but probably even less, probably better odds than that. But do not do it week in, week out. And the military get this, because you don't do live fire exercises every single day, because every now and then stuff can go wrong and people can get really badly hurt or worse. But train, train sensibly, train in a way where you can survive errors and learning opportunities. But it will do that if you want. But yeah, we just always try and not do the equivalent of a live fire exercise day in, day out.
No, that's sensible to me. Yeah. You're sort of talking about the military there, and that straight away says to me teamwork. And a lot of what you've done, I think, seems to have been around you building a great team around you. And you state that you've got to recruit people with enthusiasm, passion and experience in that order, which I really like. So how did you come to that realisation that those are the three things you need in that sort of order?
Yeah, so I mean, we're very lucky. We get, easily a dozen emails a day from people all over the world wanting to kind of give up their day jobs and come over and work for free because, they're inspired by seeing what we've done, which is very flattering. And what we try and do is, when people are not too far away from usually Goodwood, we have them come over and just hang out with us for a training day where, clients are doing flight training, or we've got military or paramedic people training. We see how they fit in, can they use a zip tie? It's a good test. We don't actually set that as a test, but no, I mean, it's like, you might have three PhDs, but can you muck in, learn on the job, work out how to refuel, a jet suit by watching one of our team do it, and then also go and, grab the coffees when we, when we've got a break? Do you have that humble, humility that means you, yes, can absolutely go and think up new ideas and be creative and capable, but also, just be passion led and do anything it takes to get that job done. I've got an amazing team of people who are very creative and capable, but at the same time will not go and just fall apart at 2 a.m. before we're supposed to be getting on a military transport to a foreign country to deliver an event, when at the moment everything is not working. There is smoke coming out of something that shouldn't be. Everything's pointing to this now being impossible. And they just knuckle down and just make it happen in a very military kind of way, and yet are fun and self-deprecating and are driven by the joy of the challenge, not about some corporate type performance target or some.
It sounds so familiar to me, having been in the forces. I'm not saying that doesn't.
No, it's that same spirit
outside.
It's that same spirit. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like a Red Arrows type selection to me. That's the type of process they put the guys through.
It's partly why I had a place to join the military. I had a place at Sandhurst when I was at university. Didn't take it up because I sort of chased money a little bit and did so many military things at university. I sort of got a little bit long in the tooth with that. But within a year or two, then went off and got my green lid with the Royal Marines. So it took me a bit longer than that, alongside my day job. But I've got a massive respect and belief in that military ethos of, especially the sort of small group special forces stuff, where you just, you have that never say die attitude, but the adaptability and that teamwork and camaraderie just to get the job done. And that is a huge part of how we operate, because we are constantly operating with no textbook, no guidance, no helping hand. We get handed the most amazing challenges where we have to in the most professional and constructive way possible, make it up as we go along, and then still survive the downsides and survive the unimaginable. It's just brilliant, and it's a great ethos that the team live and breathe, and yet they're all almost half my age. They're all in their sort of mid-early 20s.
For more than 5 years, Flight Deck Wingman has been helping pilots achieve their aviation goals. Flight Deck Wingman specialises in helping current and future pilots with bespoke application and assessment preparation to airlines and flight schools. And with 99% of these pilots being successful with their applications, Flight Deck Wingman's preparation products are the best in the business. So if you're a pilot looking to give yourself the edge, train to prepare, prepare to succeed, get yourself a wingman. Find them on social media and book your service today at flightdeckwingman.com.
It's not just the team that you work with. You've obviously got an amazingly supportive wife as well, which I know you talk about a lot in the book, and particularly one who put a hose pipe down the front of your boots. What was that all about?
Oh, yeah. So the very first flight involved having an engine on the back of each leg, even like the back where your calf muscle is, because I thought, you know, legs take load and, you know, I thought legs would be where it's at. Turns out legs have got mind of their own. You know, as soon as you lift off the ground, they start pedaling and wobbling around all over the place. You've got much less autonomy over your legs, surprisingly, than your hands. And also the practical problem with that is, as per the, you know, the French guy with the hoverboard has, you can't land and take off from anywhere unless you're on a raised, elevated, grated platform, which suddenly makes the whole thing pretty unworkable for anything other than very well set up domestic demos. So when I was learning this the hard way, the reflected heat off the concrete farmyard would make the whole area very warm, let's put it that way. And I had a load of heat shielding on the boot, but it would be delayed. So after a while, you'd feel this heat coming through, and you knew as soon as you started feeling it, it was only going to get worse. Even if you'd finished a few minutes earlier, you knew that that heat would be creeping in. So yes, the slightly crude way of solving that problem, because it's quite slow getting your feet out of those motocross boots, was just put water into your boot. So she used to very kindly do that. Yeah, but my wife's been very supportive. I mean, she kind of knew what she was getting into when she married me, I think, and that I was a fairly unusual character, but this, I think, re-stretched the definition of unusual, I think, going on this journey. And I mean, she had the faith in me that this mad journey might get somewhere interesting, when she didn't ever try and stop me. But yes, I think it bemused her a little in the early days as to what the dickens I was doing with all this. But yeah, supported me throughout.
Yeah, you actually talk quite a bit about your wife and how she's so understanding about the differences between this family life balance and this entrepreneurialism. And that sort of echoed with me. I mean, I've got a very small business, but, you know, it's very easy, isn't it, to become consumed in your own world with trying to develop something. No, I can't let that go right now. I've got to keep going. I've got to finish this. But how did you manage to balance all of that?
Yeah, I mean, this will resonate with everybody then, you know, who's gone on that journey of, you know, setting up your own business or trying to do your own thing. It is really hard, especially when you come from the background of running, you know, working for a big corporate. And my wife had known me working for that big company, which is very, you know, lots of pressure and stress. But you sort of come home in the evening and largely that's it. You know, you've got sort of stuff to catch up with, but you can disconnect at least a bit. Whereas running your own business is only you you're answerable to. No one cares if you fail. It's down to you. And it is a much better time of life in some ways to be, you know, single and 23 or something and just sleep on a couch with takeaway pizzas and just wake up 2 years later with realizing you've hardly slept and you've hopefully got a success or you've learned loads of lessons for the next venture. That is not a very conducive behavior set, you know, when you've got young teenagers and, you know, and family life. It's a very hard thing to balance. I mean, the benefit is at least, you know, I built up a financial cushion and I had built up lots of life experience to run that business. But yeah, it is hard to balance family life with going and running your own venture, that's for sure. And I think it just keeps, you just have to keep open, I think, share the challenges and try and not surprise your family with what it's going to entail too much. And it's no easy way around it. It's very difficult.
There's a really great video I've seen on Vimeo. It's called, I think it's called Warbird Pilot Behind the Visor. And this guy is into Reno air racing. That's his thing. You know, it takes up all of his time. It's obviously a very risky type of business. And he says that none of it would be worth it without his wife and kids. I think that's true. And it sounds like you and your wife make a really great team, actually, Richard, to support you.
Yeah, because I think there's so many pitfalls that you mistake. Well, you know, endless business books will tell you that, or startup books will tell you, you know, it's just like that has to be everything. You're living and breathing everything to do with that small startup to give it a chance of success. And even then, it's very statistically unlikely to succeed. So everything else ends up, if you're not careful, including your health and relationships and whatever, can end up getting thrown by the wayside. But then you wake up, you know, a few years later, even if it has been successful, and wonder at what cost. So it is very hard. And the solution isn't always just enrolling your other half into the business, because then you are both immersed in the stress of it. But at the same time, if you don't involve them at all as well, they just lose connection with you. So yeah, it's just hard. It was a challenge. But we were a good team.
And we mentioned earlier your dad, and it was really moving to read in the book about the passing of your dad, because he was a true innovator. And it sounds to me like, you know, this is obviously something where everything that, or a large amount of what you are now, came from your dad. Were there any sort of times where you thought, you know, I'm going down the same path here, do you think that you've taken a completely different path? Because it's different times, isn't it, now? And I guess, you know, with the internet we mentioned, you know, you can realise, there's more chance of realising your ambition and goals, etc.
Yeah, I mean, a big inhibition I had, I was a bit of a split personality, really. I mean, on the one hand, I've always felt like I was a sort of a bit of a black sheep, innovator, want to, you know, as soon as somebody says, oh, something can't be done, I'm always interested in, well, why not? And as soon as a whole crowd is off doing something, I'm more interested if I'm going the other way. I mean, sound like I'm a complete hermit or antisocial person. No, I'm just more, I like being on the edge of a crowd, always questioning and challenging without hopefully being too annoying. That has always been very much me. But the experience of losing my father, who went down that journey of setting up his own business, and it ultimately ended up with his, you know, his suicide at my age of being 15, that just taught me the mother of all, you know, make failure recoverable. We've mentioned it right at the beginning. I think that's where it comes from. That yes, go and be an innovator and a crazy black sheep and question and challenge everything. But when it doesn't work out, which it won't work out most of the time, because that's the nature of the beast, make sure you can get back up again. Because otherwise, if you can't get back up again, and usually that means financially, you know, or, you know, emotionally, then you're not going to have another bite of the cherry. You're not going to have another go, because it might take those 19 out of 20 goes and before you succeed. And it might be go number 20, unfortunately. And his experience, or experience with him, it just taught me that something, you know, extremely powerfully. So I think I was lucky to kind of meander my way towards oil trading, because it allowed me to be entrepreneurial and creative, but inside a protective box of a big corporation, which I've got a lot to thank for. But it never fully gave me the freedom to scratch that itch that I really wanted to scratch. So as I started to go down this route of, you know, road of gravity, and I did it, you know, evenings and weekends, but as it worked technically, I realized, oh my God, this is now the bigger challenge. What the hell do I do with this? You know, and it was over the winter of 2016, spring 2017, that I realized I was going to form a company out of it to try and brand it and package it and launch it in a professional way, not just be a 5-minute YouTube funny. And because I believe there was some potential in it, but everything, all the red lights came on in my head, because it looked like, uh-oh, this is exactly what I remember my father doing, you know, being maybe, was it too self-confident? Who do I think I am? I'm going to throw away a perfectly good day job. I'm going to put the family at risk, and I'm going to go and do my thing. It was all the things I remember from my childhood. And I just had this branded in my head ultimate outcome of, look what happened when it didn't work out. So it was an enormous emotional burden to go down that road. And so as it started to, you know, and it was hard fought, but as I started to see more and more signs of success, like getting asked to do TED 2017, and like, you know, Red Bull and Wired wanting to do our sort of co-launch together for fun, you know, that was very, you know, real sort of rite of passage, if you like. And as people started paying for us to do at events, and as we started to get, you know, the military involved, and I mean, yeah, you know, the chalking up those milestones of I suppose, respect or credibility for the idea, which on the face of it still looks insane, right? But we've flown around the aircraft carrier, you know, I've hung out with the First Sea Lord for quite a lot of time, you know, talking about innovation. And, you know, the Royal Marines are, I can't speak on their behalf, but, you know, between you and me and anybody possibly listening, we're in, and two other special forces units in Europe just in the last few weeks have signed up saying, right, no, because of the demos and the guys we trained, they're on, you know, we have revolutionized what they do from a maritime boarding perspective. Oh my God, you know, who would have thought this four and a half years ago in that farmyard? So every time you get that validatory step, it is really humbling, because I feel like, and I'm satisfied in the last 2 years, let's say, I'm satisfied we got out of the woods. You know, so we have not raised money in 4 years of running this business. It's made more money every year than we've spent, and it's financially very healthy, a very diverse portfolio of activity. And we've flourished during COVID because of our adaptability. I'm very proud of all of that, more proud really than the technology behind it. But all of that has been a big emotional journey to not feel like I was sliding into that, you know, awful repeat of what I experienced as a kid. So yeah, big deal really for me to get through all
that.
Yeah,
I think watching, and for anyone that's not seen it, I don't know what the actual title of the YouTube video is, but if you YouTube search for Richard Browning boarding a ship, I'm sure it will come up.
Yeah, maritime. But, I don't know. Yeah, it's a good question. Well, if you go to Gravity Industries YouTube, it's one of the top five or six films on there. It's HMS Tamar and boarding the ship, yeah, with the Royal Marines. That was...
It's incredible. You know, even for me, actually, Richard, watching it, and you either are or not aware of the effect that sort of thing has on someone. But when you see somebody who's had a journey from coming up with an idea, and especially being ex-forces as well, and then see you taking off a rib and boarding this ship, it's a genuinely emotional experience for viewers watching it as well, because it's not only really, really cool, it's seeing that concept of yours develop. And I'll admit to being a bit sort of emotional watching that type of thing and seeing someone who's come up with this idea do that. I think it's absolutely amazing, and I take my hat off to you for doing it.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I mean, a lot of stress and pressure went to delivering. You know, there's no practice for all of that, and launching off the front of a bouncing around rib. Again, the story behind that, because it's a stupid idea, the story behind that was to simply minimize the ask of the military in kinetic and DSDL. And you imagine the process we went through. It was to minimize the ask, because I didn't want to modify the existing equipment. So I said, you know what, I'll launch from anywhere you like off the existing platform. So we just literally had a modified launch seat right in the most bouncy, stupid part of the boat. But there's no other equipment there, other than whether you're sort of tethering the davit or whatever. I'm trying to get more familiar with all these naval terms. When you're winching the thing out the water, there's a thing on the front you don't want to get in the way of.
Hauling away handsomely. Sir,
yeah, all of that. Yeah, exactly. Other than that, there's nothing else going on in the bow of the boat, because it's the most stupid place to be generally, because it bounces around. But I still prove that even in, you know, 20 knots and, you know, fairly rolly sea, you can see the films, I can still launch backwards to go and assault a target ship from that, and to really make a point of just how adaptable this equipment is. And it's really nice. I tell you what, it's a lot more fun watching those films afterwards than actually doing it. Doing it, you're just filled constantly with the risk of, probably like your old job with the Harriers. I imagine afterwards.
That's exactly what was in my mind.
Yeah,
there.
I bet in the bar afterwards, it's brilliant fun, right? But when at the moment, you know, in the dark, you know, with a, you know, terrible weather where you're genuinely not sure if you're going to get this thing on the ground or not, that is not fun. You just.
It's not at all.
No, unless
Chuck Yeager or something, and I'm definitely not.
I'm just filled with all the. Yeah. You know, I'm just constantly analysing what could go wrong the whole time, trying to manage it off in my head. No, afterwards when it's all gone great, you know, home for tea and medals or whatever, then it's brilliant. But yeah, at the time it's pretty stressful. Yeah.
All this, you mentioned something in a book, it's called the dopamine and the DRD4, I've written it down, -7R gene extension.
So I'm going to blame...
Big subject, that.
I'm going to blame the ghostwriter who I worked very closely with, and I did rewrite a lot of it because, you know, a lot of the technical stuff I had to write in my own language, but that was one of his creations, which I like, I have to say, but yes, I'm not an expert on the precise genomic element, but I think it's all about... It's all about having that sort of outlier, creative, innovative gene. I think it's the annoying couple of people in a 50-person tribe that were unhappy with their current location and always wonder what was over the scary-looking hill. It's those people where I completely get that evolution and evolution generally punishes that behavior, because over the hill is something scary and rubbish, and you probably starve or get trampled by rhinos or something. But you know, increasingly that behavior is what we need, I think, obviously biased, because that, you know, that word innovation again, we're on this pathway ever since we stopped being hunter-gatherers and we started messing around with planting seeds and things. We're on that journey of innovation and adapting the world around us to try and survive. And we can't go back. You know, it's unsustainable entirely to support the number of people on this planet now if we don't keep innovating. And this is a bit of a tangent, but, you know, watching... As I expected, with the COP 26, as there have been a lot of them, which is a bit embarrassing. But that gathering, you know, where everybody has to have a consensual outcome, you know, oh, good Lord, you know, as imagined, it's not really gone and, I was going to say, set the world on fire. Well, it probably has with their outcome. You know, it's going to be left field innovations. It's like the announcement that the Chinese might have just made a major leap in nuclear fusion. It's those things that are going to save our planet. You know, it's the quiet innovators, engineers and scientists who just go, hang on a minute, we don't need to burn anything now because we've just come up with a more economic, much more exciting solution. You know, look at what's happening with, you know, light bulbs, right? You know, LED lighting has just quietly removed a huge amount of energy being burnt in filament lights, and it's happened because they were cheaper and nicer and cooler and more fun than the old ones. That's realistically how we're going to solve this. It's not by telling everybody just to burn less, because there's just no way that the Western world is going to downgrade their existence.
You must be throwing rocks at the TV when you were watching some of these.
You know, and I don't mean to sound like I'm some sort of mad, you know, denier oil industry. I'm really not at all. I think the industry deserves to die, frankly. But what I passionately believe is we've got to proactively be on the front foot to innovate our way out of these problems, not just sort of go and put an extra jumper on and sit quietly in our houses. As much as that might help, it's just not going to happen. People aren't going to do it. So, you've got me on my innovation bandwagon.
My cheeks are hurting from laughing at all these analogies, but you're spot on with everything that you're saying. What do you do to sort of free up this active mind of yours? Because I really suffer with it. I mean, for me, it manifests itself in just not being able to sleep. I just can't sleep. Some other idea comes into my head. I'm like, ping, oh, I've got to do that. And I make a new task, another task on my iPhone. What do you do to free your mind?
Run. Yeah, Forrest Gump style. I even got into ultramarathon running. I used to, it's in the book, I got into a weird habit on a Friday night. I'd commute, I'd get up at 5 a.m, cycle down to the station, get on the train, cycle across London, do my day job, go to the gym 3 times a week, and then repeat the whole thing to come back again. And my brain was so wired come Friday evening, I would struggle to kind of wind down. And so some point on Saturday morning, usually about 1 a.m, I'd be wide awake, ready to go commuting again. So I would get my running shoes on and just go for a run. And it was the only time in the week where there was no emails, no phone calls, nobody wanting to ask me where I am or anything like that. And then I'd sometimes look down and realize I'd be running for 20K. And it was just wonderful. And I'd listen to podcasts or, you know, news, interviews, whatever. And that turned into doing ultramarathons because I'd start to realize actually getting reasonably good at these weird long runs. But I don't do the ultramarathon so much nowadays. But I do use running as my biggest kind of brain calming process. You know, I find, and there's a lot of science around this now, you know, the rhythmic distraction of your huge network of nervous muscular goings on, very technical, does seem to force your brain into a calmer mindset and ideas come to the fore and all the rest of it.
For me, windsurfing does that for me.
Yeah, there you go.
I think it's, and also my gliding, something where I've got my mind focused on another task.
Yeah.
And it's usually almost seems like quite a basic task. It probably isn't. Maybe it is, but for whatever reason, it's that sort of active meditation, isn't it, that people talk about, I think.
So here's a funny anecdote. So I did a brain scanning experiment for a Cambridge University bunch where they stuck probes all over my head and wanted to work out what was going on in my head when I flew. And the experiment was I would go up into the hover and then fly up and down our sort of zip wire system whilst they would, you know, observe what I was doing. My background noise in my head went almost flatline as soon as I took off. So they said that I was exhibiting something that they've only ever seen in people who experience flow state in probably like a fast jet pilot or something like that, where there's a really all encapsulating, all encompassing task. And yet you've got so good at it and so natural that your conscious mind isn't aware of it. So actually running is a good example, because actually to manage all the firings of all the muscles to make sure you don't fall on your face is a Boston Dynamics massive headache. And yet none of us think about it. You can happily hold a conversation and think about other stuff, have a phone call, whatever. But your brain is, big chunk of your brain is doing a really complicated task and almost therefore liberating another part of your brain, your conscious brain, to have a clearer experience. And so, yeah, to my surprise, they said that they were seeing that in me when I was flying. It's kind of very strange.
This flow state, it sounds like something I need to go and investigate, because I think that is the, I need to figure out how to get into it a bit more often.
Well, flying a Harrier, probably not so much all your modern civil airliners, which is, you know, you just have to press go now, don't you really? That's probably not doing it for you, frankly. It's probably why you can't sleep. Because if you unplug, you clearly can't do all this, but unplug all the autopilot rubbish and then, you know, then do it all manual.
My gliding, mate. I need to get you up in a glider and take you cross country.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Let's maybe one with a jet engine.
I'll hold your scary lithium batteries and be ready to throw them out if they start fizzing or swelling. Yes.
Rich, I want to. You would sort of touch on a few phrases. One of them was talking about being on the outside, and there's some really cool phrases I picked up from in the book that I want to go over because I think they're awesome. So the first one was "be the penguin on the outside."
Yeah,
I was trying to sort of briefly explain what these phrases mean.
Yeah, I think that just for me is in danger of making you feel like you've got a very cold ass. Because when you look at those penguins on the outside, you think the ones on the outside must be
facing.
Yeah, I think they face inwards. I think I prefer the black sheep thing, really. I think that's probably a better analogy, where you're still in the flock, but you're probably on the edge of the flock, and you are a sheep. And you do all, you look and sound like a sheep, but you've got a bit of a license to just think slightly differently or behave slightly differently. I think that's better. The penguin one was more of, you know, you're on the outside of the group. You've got some autonomy to shuffle around and move around and question the group rather than just being crushed in the middle. But
if you
want
to warm your backside, you can step back.
I think that's the downside of that particular analogy, I think, that was in the book. Yeah.
What's this one then? Watch out for icebergs. That's another one.
Yeah, I think that's a more pertinent one I use when you're talking about innovation. So, you know, when you are, you know, you're a big corporate, and I'm sure people listening to this who are part of big organizations are going to know what this feels like. You know, that you're surrounded by people who are incentivized to minimize risk, come around and tell you no to everything because that minimizes risk. And yet the problem with that is you are just the Titanic sailing towards the existential iceberg. If you've not done the micro innovations, the little adaptations, the little adjustments, and you've not realized that there is a big change coming, and you've not made those small course corrections in a less painful way, by the time you see that big existential threat, you know, Kodak and digital photography, even though they invented it, you can't steer around it, and you smack into it, and all those people who are worrying about risk are now floundering around in the water. I think it's that, really.
Amazing. Another one is laziness is the father of invention. I think that came from the story there was of the guy that invented the computer because he didn't like doing maths. Is
it? Oh, I don't remember that. I should read my own book again, but I'm not sure about that one. It's definitely true to say, and I think of this in my eldest child because he does remind me of me a lot. He's constantly looking for the easy option, but actually, to a point, that is what innovators are often good at, because in one moment it can look like laziness, but actually looking at the process, looking at the system and going, gosh, this is really tedious, I don't want to accept this, how can we make this easier, less painful and more efficient, that is driven by an inherent laziness of not wanting to do it as it is now. If you're a little bit mindless and you just do it and never question it, that's not laziness, but that's not being maybe as creative as you could be. So they're for parents out there that can look at their children not wanting to help with a dishwasher, then maybe you should have all the cupboards as dishwashers. I should patent this idea. All the cupboards are dishwashers. And then all you do is put dirty plates back in the cupboards and they just wash overnight. And then you've cut out one leg.
We're going to open a separate YouTube channel to do with Richard Browning's ideas on how to manage children in the kitchen.
Yeah. But there you go. There's an example. You know, moaning children not wanting to unload the dishwasher. Maybe they should go and invent that thing. Anyway,
I won't make you explain the others, but these are just some other throwaway lines. Pondering the imponderables. I thought that was a really good one. Mm-hmm. Prove, not predict.
Yep.
Yeah. And this is the last one I've got. A hamster wheel of challenges, which I think is so true. That literally, I reckon I'm on about 10 hamster wheels at any one time.
Yeah. Well, without getting too deep. So you probably need to go and just dig into what is it in your past that has got you... The miserable psychologist would say running away, because you could argue, although we didn't discuss it, but you know, the miserable interpretation of me is I'm just running away from all that trauma of a childhood. But that's just not very constructive, is it? But to what extent, what are you running away from, distracting yourself endlessly from? Or what are you trying to prove or get to? You know, it's a bit like if you keep constantly climbing mountains, you'll notice that get to the top is quite unfulfilling. It's like, where's the next mountain? Oh, there's a bigger one over there. I've got to go and do that one next. It's quite healthy to try the best you can and be your own psychologist to understand what is it that you're trying to achieve here, because you do risk burning yourself out constantly hamster wheeling all the time.
Absolutely. Where do you see that for you then, Richard? Where do you see that, you know, for you? Are you able to put your finger on it and go, I know what I'm trying to achieve? Or are you not quite a hamster wheel, you're constantly challenging but sort of enjoying that process? Where would you reckon you sit?
Yeah, I think I'm at peace to an extent with my journey of constantly restlessly enjoying the, I mean, there's a brand new suit sitting on the desk behind there, which is a good thing you're not showing this, because that's supposed to be secret. You know, that, but I'm really excited by that, because it starts quicker, it's more powerful, and yet it's really small. Two of my team are away. They've literally lived together for 3 days hardly slept to cad it up before a big event we're doing in Brazil. This is a mad one in about 2-3 weeks' time. So we're under the cosh. We love these pressures. Maybe they don't. I love putting them under that pressure. No, they love it dearly. To see if we can get that on the plane to go and test out in the jungle, which is a mad, you know, thing to happen.
In the jungle,
yeah,
amazing.
So, and I shouldn't even say that really. But anyway, that's exciting, as you can probably tell by me getting excited about it. So I don't know if we can achieve what I've set out. I don't know if what we're going to put in the suitcases to go out there for that event is going to do what we need it to do, but I'm very excited if it works. So I think I do like those little journeys, and I'm at peace with the fact that each time you get to the top, it isn't some nirvana. It's just a starting point for another little journey.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it.
Yeah, and I feel like I've done enough. I feel a lot more happy that the 16 years I worked for a big corporate feels like 1 year of my 4 years of existing, running my own business and going on this mad journey of gravity. So I feel very happy that I've had the privilege of experiencing those worlds. And I think the final thing to say is, I think my new challenge to myself is whether I can genuinely translate this awful word innovation into actionable behaviors that particularly civil service, government, military, which, like very large organizations, really struggle to walk that walk. I'm having some really exciting success in giving them, in a very collaborative way, some really meaty actions that allow them to liberate their brilliant people to do more of that proper innovation and not just talk about it at a next conference 6 months later.
I think we're figuring out where Richard Browning's going with all this, and it's to effect some big change.
That's my high, I feel like that's my self-imposed higher purpose, to try and use the jet suit as a bit of a metaphor for doing proper, meaningful, nimble innovation. And it's having 16 years in a corporate and innovating there, bit of time in the military, and having built a very public manifestation of innovation in the form of the jet suit. I've so far not found it very easy for anybody to particularly constructively argue against what I'm saying, because I've got that weird perspective. I'm not a 23-year-old that's never worked for a big company. I'm not somebody who doesn't know really how the military works. I, do you know what I mean? I've accidentally built a fairly useful context to try and deliver and enact constructive, non-judgmental, positive change, if that makes sense. You know, that sounds all very...
It certainly does to me. We're almost done, Richard, so I know you're a very busy person. I've got a quick quote here from a test pilot mate of mine, actually, called he's retired commander in 8th Grey. He was the first to land an F-35 on board HMS Queen Elizabeth.
Hopefully not the one that just went in the water, because I understand it's usually me going in the water with the test. So that was expensive.
He did say to me, I'm probably going to get a phone call.
Oh, yeah, jeez.
Because he did all the trials of the boat. But he said, I said to him, would you like to fly the jet suit? He said, this is a quote, yes, I'd love a go on that bad boy hover suit. Looks much harder than F-35 and as perilous as a fully laden Sea Harrier.
No, well, it's definitely not. So we've had the former chief test pilot of the US program, a wonderful colonel I probably shouldn't mention, who's an extended member of our team from the US. He can fly one, and he's brilliant. And no, he loves it. He feels like it's a sort of strapping on an F-35. No, it's a lot easier than. Well, I suppose in a way, landing an F-35, unlike your Harrier, is just pressing a land button. You're not even allowed to be part of the process, are you? Because you can't react quick enough if it gets it wrong. Anyway, it's certainly a lot cheaper if you get it wrong with ours. Let's put it that way. There's a big bill lurking around the Ministry of Defence now.
There's a deep ocean in the Mediterranean, I believe. So yeah, at least the pilot's okay. Well done, Martin Baker. I want to say there's another really cool innovation.
Yes.
An ejection seat saves so many people's lives. Richard, I'm moving towards the end here now in our what we call the winging it section.
Yes.
So it's a bit of a random question, not related to anything we've spoken about. Are you ready for your winging it question?
Yes, go for it.
If you could travel to any point in time, where and when would that be? And what piece of equipment would you take with you?
Well, it's going to have to be something obviously flying related. I mean, it would be amazing, although maybe very disenfranchising, to sort of bring a jet suit back and show the Wright brothers or Da Vinci. I think it'd be Da Vinci would be more cool. I think the Wright brothers would be a bit like, oh, you know, I feel like I wouldn't want to set them off their course of delivering what you basically do as a day job, because that's going really well. Proper normal sensible flying has gone very well indeed. I never want to be guilty of kind of suggest what we do is a replacement or substitute for any normal helicopter, you know, rotor wing or fixed wing flying. But I think, wouldn't it be cool to go back to Da Vinci and say, look, you know, you had wood and canvas, but you dreamed of, I believe, the sort of freedom of flight that we can do. And wouldn't it be amazing giving Da Vinci a go on the training rig? There you go. That would be fun, wouldn't it?
What would it do if it didn't work out?
And knock us up a quick, knock us up a quick painting, and we'll tuck it away in the, put it on eBay after you've gone. that's eBay. The only condition. Yes, exactly.
Who uses eBay these
days? No, we'll bring it forward. After we've gone back in time, and Sherman Jetsy, we'll bring one of his paintings back forward in time. Christie's would be more appropriate than eBay. But anyway, that's the only condition I put on that. Yeah.
What would you do if you end up in the wrong time though, in front of a Tyrannosaurus Rex?
I'll fly away. I think it'd be pretty
for 90 seconds.
Oh no, we can go for longer than that. Yeah, get 4 or 5 minutes. Then we can get about 5K. Okay. I think it would run away. I think it would run away pretty quickly, having started up. They're pretty damn loud. It's nearly as loud as your last piece of equipment.
You want to go and hover on his head?
Yeah. Yes.
Richard, what do you think is going to be the future? Like, where do you see the jet suit going? Because I know I saw you flying the electric, well, you won't call it electric jet suit. What do we call it? Electric suit?
We call it got a different name? The e-suit. Launched it at Goodwood. I mean, it's a starting point. We didn't even know it was going to be feasible, to be honest. It weighs twice as much as a normal jet suit, about 60 kilos. It flew for about 15 seconds with our lightest pilot, and then the batteries recovered a bit, and there was about 10 seconds and then a bit more, about 5 seconds. It was very hard, but as the world gets their head around better batteries, we're ready to embrace them. I mean, look, we never built this as a mainstream form of transport. It has got a growing number of really very powerful niche applications like special forces mobility, boarding operations and things like that. For people who think it's too loud, well, no, you can't hear it about 500 meters away. When it starts up, you come in so fast the target, you don't notice until it's too late. The hands-free thing is another thing people think, oh, you can't possibly use it. Well, fire and maneuver in infantry tactics, you're not supposed to be firing whilst you're maneuvering, if people hadn't noticed that. And we've got a suppressive capability we don't tend to show people. But anyway, so special forces mobility is real and happening. The friendly, more day-glow version of that is paramedic response. That's also happening. Yeah. We are imminently hours away from signing a sponsorship deal with a big firm that is going to see us train up some paramedics in the UK, which is very cool. And again, think of paramedic response on a motorbike, getting quickly through the traffic to a casualty to stabilize breathing and blood flow and things like that. That in that world, and I'm not a paramedic, but I've learned, is the most important stage. Getting them back to hospital, which is clearly not what we're going to do underslung under a jet suit, is not actually the most important part of the process. It's that initial stabilization, and we can get there very quickly to do that. So that's all happening.
Yeah, one of my next podcast guests is a helicopter pilot, oil and rig helicopter pilot, but he's actually a mountain rescue lead as well.
Oh, right.
And also spent some time doing some sneaky beaky stuff in the forces.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, it'd be really interesting to, wouldn't it be cool?
What region does he says to do mountain rescue?
So he lives up in Aberdeenshire near Aboyne.
Oh, okay.
But he's based out in Norway at the moment.
Oh, okay.
I'll put you in touch if you like. He's a really nice guy. Yeah.
So we're out and we are going to be out in Norway. They've got this is a one that's come in recently, where they've got some sort of emergency services kind of competition in the summer, and we're part of that. So we're going to be flying in with a defibrillator and showing how, and also we might be doing some of their fjord rescue stuff as well. So you fly across a fjord up the side of a mountain and then, attend to a tourist with a heart condition type problem. We should be doing some of that next summer. So yeah, maybe we might see him out there with the rate we're going. But
that'd be amazing. I mean, to sort of see someone stepping out of a helicopter and then flying off, instead of having to go through the snow, some of the stuff he does, which sounds pretty mental.
Yeah.
And to be able to get there quickly, like you say, that's incredible.
So that's all happening. So we've got two divisions of the company. One is professional, which is military and search and rescue. The other one is entertainment, which is, oh, look, it looks like Iron Man. I want to have a go. I want you at an event. I want to do our race series, I want to do the electric version, whatever. That's all grown very quickly as well. You never say never in terms of whether this becomes more and more mainstream. It's accelerating so quickly that it's not impossible to imagine it gradually creeping into more and more realms of existence.
Amazing. Richard, I'm going to wind it up now. It's been amazing. My cheeks are genuinely hurting from laughing and smiling at all the stuff you've spoken about. And I like these podcasts because they are podcasts. You listen to things, but it's been really engaging talking with you sort of face to face as we are here. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me and for putting your genuinely inspirational story out there for everyone. I've really enjoyed it.
My pleasure, Andrew.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of For Flying Out Loud. If you enjoy the podcast and you want the episodes to keep coming, please show your support by buying me a coffee. You can find a link in the episode description. Thanks, everybody. Stay safe.